Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by EV Mobility, here to keep you moving. For daily life, travel, or just having fun, visit goevmobility.com. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Shubin.
Chris Makowski, and this morning we are going to talk Civil War and lots of good things and a book that he was part of editing, and we're going to get into all that in just a second. Chris, it is a great to have you here. Good morning.
I'm so excited to be back, Ted. Thanks for having me.
You have become the show's resident historian. I gave you that title this morning,
I feel very official. It's great. In fact, I walked into the lobby of the station, and there was a neat little sign that you guys put up. Thank you for that. It says, Welcome, Chris Makowski, historian. I was like, oh, I feel so important.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I always struggle at how do I refer to you? Because, you know, you have a lot of different lives. You're a college professor. That's how I first knew you.
Sure.
as a college professor. You are a historian. You're an author. You're involved with Emerging Civil War. You're still the editor-in-chief
of
that blog. And also involved with the Central Virginia Battlefields Trust. And I'm sure there are other things I've missed.
I think my most important hats are dad and grandpa, which are the funnest hats to wear, obviously. But and it's neat to kind of wear so many different hats and get to do so many things. My dad told me when I was young in life, he said, if you find a way to get paid to do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. Yeah. And that's been the honest truth. I get to live the dream, and I am super fortunate and blessed to be able to do that. So.
Well, and the interesting thing when I first met you, and it's hard for me to think of you as a grandfather, because I met you and your daughter over on Route 3.
On the First Day Battlefield.
First Day Battlefield. Right. Yes. Yeah. And you explained to me that you were driving down from New York. You're a professor at St. Bonaventure.
Correct.
And you and your daughter came and for years did things at the Stonewall Jackson Shrine.
Yeah, for years and years we would work one weekend a month for the National Park Service at Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. And we'd drive down on a Friday night and we'd work all day Saturday, we'd work all day Sunday, and then we'd drive home Saturday night. It's about a 7-hour trip. And we did that for years. And that's how I got involved and invested in this particular park. People used to say, like, well, why don't you just move down there? And A, like, I got a great job at St. Bonaventure that I love. And B, the traffic in Fredericksburg is terrible. I'd never move. And then, 9 years ago, I met the right girl and moved down here. The things you do for love.
Right? But you're still going back and forth, and I'm sure with Zoom and things like that, it changed things and made things a little easier.
Yeah, and it's kind of neat because online education was becoming more and more of a thing even before the pandemic really hit, and so I'd been teaching online in various capacities actually since 2000, and so it was an easy transition for me to go fully online when COVID hit, but it was something that we were working on anyway, so that made that transition easier. Because I'm actually a writing professor rather than a history professor, a lot of that's individualized instruction anyway, where I'm working one-on-one with a student, and I'm going to help you with your commas, and I'm going to help Susie with her paragraphs, and I'm going to help John with his organization, and so, like, I've got to do that kind of work anyway, so that lends itself to being online. In a way that maybe if I was teaching hard sciences, I couldn't do.
One of the things, and so many things have changed, but with the pandemic, but whether it's the Emerging Civil War or the Central Virginia Battlefields Trust, certain groups and things have hardly skipped a beat and have continued on. Especially we did a show recently with the Central Virginia Battlefields Trust, and just the acquisition of property continues in the work there, and Emerging Civil War that's online, and people continue to contribute and great stuff coming out of there.
Yeah, and it was neat because as people were restricted because of COVID and they had to lock down, they were turning to their computers for something to do, if nothing else. And so the technology really allowed organizations to start providing content and programming and you know, all sorts of Civil War stuff online that you couldn't find before. And so there's just a wealth of stuff out there. Even still today, as things are starting to open up, you can still go online and hear some great talks and see some great history.
Yeah, things continue on. For people that aren't aware, Emerging Civil War, talk about that for a little bit.
So Emerging Civil War is sort of this loose confederacy of historians, and I don't mean that with a capital C. There are 34 of us right now. Most of us come from public history backgrounds, which means we've worked at parks or we've worked in museums where we're interacting with the public about history. And lots of different interests, lots of different backgrounds, lots of different writing styles. And we all contribute to this blog, www.emergingcivilwar.com, with free content every day. And we're just trying to help people stay connected with the Civil War. Now, we are a .com, but we're actually a 501c. The idea for Emerging Civil War started because Chris White, my partner in crime, he and I were sitting down at the caretaker's house at the Jackson Shrine one night with our friend Jake Struhelka. And Jake worked for the Park Service at the time. So we're sitting on the porch and we're smoking cigars and having a beer. And we're like, you know, we should start up a blog, like the, you know, but instead of one person, it should be like several of us. Let's get together some people whose work we really like, and we'll use that as a platform for writing about the war. And so that's how Emerging Civil War got started 11 years ago, coming up in just a couple of weeks. And we have grown since then from, I think there were six or seven of us to start with. There are 34 of us now. Some people have come, some people have gone. And so it's just kind of a neat community of Civil War historians. And they're based all across the country. Since we're a digital presence, it's easy to kind of have that national scope.
The interest in the Civil War and the topics just it never ends. It's fascinating to me that you still come up with, and historians and writers still come up with new topics and new things.
Yeah, people ask all the time, like, what more is there to say? It's 160 years ago. And in some regards, yeah, that's true. But like, people are finding new, you know, letters and diaries. So, you know, the new source materials continues to show up. But also, I think the way we look at the war and think about the war changes. You know, once upon a time, it was very micro-tactical. This regiment had this many people, and they marched these many steps, and the colonel's shoe size was an 11 and a half, you know, like super detailed like that. And now there's a lot more talk about the impact on civilians, about the enslaved population. People will always be interested in the human interest stories. So lots of new ways to still talk about some history that we might think is familiar.
It is. People are finding things in their attics, or like you say, they're finding letters. I mean, I think it's just like over at Ferry Farm, they keep finding things and telling the story differently.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing.
Yeah. And so you know, just being able to, and the other thing too is like, the war is still new to whole new audiences, because like, new people are being born and growing up and discovering history, and like, oh wow. So like, yeah, the Civil War is 160 years old, or in this area, you've got a tremendous colonial history as well. And that's new to new audiences every day. So helping people find those and connect with them and explore them, to me, that's the real fun of doing history, is like kindling people's passion and interest in getting them more deeply invested.
No, and especially as the Central Virginia Battlefield Trust gains some of these parcels of land, to go onto some of this land, like you say, whether you're seeing some of the Park Service sites for the first time, or some of the land that the Central Virginia Battlefield Trust, you get on that land and there's a different feeling to it when you know the story.
Absolutely. And you know, a lot of people will look at a field and be like, oh, it's a field. Well, why should I preserve that? Well, you know, if you know what happened there, then you can go walk out on that ground and be like, oh, well, you know, I didn't see this swale, and that's why these guys moved in this direction, and why this guy didn't get hit, or how that changed the course of the battle, or, you know, and it's a much different perspective than looking at maps on an arrow, which can also be useful, but like the topography, it's, I liken it to a primary source. Where, you know, you've got someone's letter or a diary or a journal. Well, having the ground is also like one of those primary sources that helps you understand what happened in a particular spot. And I also think it's just like, it is so wicked cool to walk in the footsteps of history and be where history happened.
Yeah.
And have that physical connection to a story that might be 160 years old, but you can see what those guys saw. Or you can, you know, be where something happened. And that's, you know, my favorite part is when I take someone out there who's had an ancestor and like, let's go walk in the footsteps of your great, great, great grandfather. And yeah. like, I've had people cry, you know, because they've been able to finally connect with their ancestor's story in a way like that. And it's such a poignant experience. And it's so exciting. It's so exciting.
No, I think I first experienced that years ago when going with Frank O'Reilly, when he led a tour on the, on Stonewall Jackson's flank march. And we were, like you say, we were down. You couldn't see Route 3. All of a sudden, it became apparent of how this happened mm-hmm. and in how the Union didn't see it. And yeah. and you see it all over the place at Slaughter Pen Farm.
Yeah, yeah.
Same thing.
Yep, yeah, yep. Yeah. And so when you get out there and you put your boots on the ground and you walk around, and it just opens up your perspectives about what happened and why. And to me, that's so illuminating.
Chris Makowski here this morning. We're talking Civil War. We've got much more to talk about. We're going to jump into this book that he was involved with editing too, the great What Ifs of the American Civil War. Great, great book. More coming up on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by EV Mobility. Here to keep you moving for daily life, travel, or just having fun, visit goevmobility.com. Miss an episode of Town Talk? No problem. Just subscribe to the Town Talk podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Chris Makowski in this morning. We are talking Civil War. One of the things, again, one of your hats, Central Virginia Battlefields Trust, there's a symposium coming up this, not the too distant future, that people in the area might want to know about.
So we've got the, for CVBT, they have their annual conference that's coming up in the fall. I can't remember the dates, first weekend of October, I
think so, yeah, and something like that. New September, late September, early October.
Yeah, and the theme for that is Fredericksburg 1862, and so, yeah, 160th anniversary of that. So there'll be a chance to do some tours and hear some programs and just kind of explore the area's 1862 history and some of the things that CVBT has done to preserve important pieces of ground and help the Park Service in you know, telling that story. Biggest thing probably there would be the Slaughter Pen Farm. Obviously, you know,
yeah.
millions of dollars spent to save the entire south end of the battlefield, which has rewritten the way we tell that story and helped us understand it in fundamentally different ways. So great example of how preservation can really have a significant impact on how we understand our own history.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was such a moment. And I remember, and it really was, Frank O'Reilly had talked about that piece of that what happened there being so important in the Battle of Fredericksburg, because I think at the time all of us thought, well, Marie's Heights,
Stonewall, Sunken Road, Marie's Heights,
that was the story.
That's what was preserved. That's, you know, and but if you think about, you know, this was a Confederate victory, we're in the South, so of course the locals want to preserve that part where they had kind of their most overwhelming part of the victory. And that's where the focus of the story ended up. But Frank's really the one who did the detective work to find out that Union Commander Ambrose Burnside had a different map than his commander at the south end of the field, William Franklin. And so as they're sending orders and communicating back and forth, they don't have a common frame of reference. So that leads to some catastrophic misunderstanding of orders on Franklin's part, who doesn't take the time to clarify.
Yeah.
And launches all these attacks across the south end of the field. And so whole, you know, preserving that south end of the field allowed us to really explore that story and tell it in its fullness. And it really changes the dynamics of what Burnside was really up to.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. Speaking of the Battle of Fredericksburg, you have a book out that we will talk about when we get closer to December. But it is dealing with the Battle of Fredericksburg.
It's called Decisions at Fredericksburg. It's from the University of Tennessee Press. It's a part of a series that they have called Command Decisions of the Civil War. And it's really, rather than a kind of a straightforward narrative, hard to beat Frank's book as far as just a good straightforward narrative.
Yeah.
It really takes a look at the key decisions that influenced how the battle unfolded. And, you know, what did each commander think about in each moment? What were their options and the pros and cons of those choices?
Chris Bukowski in this morning, and we were talking Civil War. So one of your latest books, The Great What Ifs of the American Civil War, this is a book that you and another person edited. What a great book.
Thanks.
Because it's the kind of topic, and it seems as though when you get interested in the Civil War and you start thinking about things, you look at these topics and many of them are come up all the time.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, I call it beer and cigars talk, where, you know, you're sitting around having a beer with your buddy, smoking a cigar, or, you know, maybe walking around the battlefield.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, what if this had happened here, you know? And then you start kind of talking. And so it's really good, a fun way to armchair general some things. And for me, it's not necessarily like, you know, running forward with wishful thinking or fantasizing, but, you know, let's use this as an opportunity to really kind of talk about, well, what was going on at the time and what were the choices and, you know, what were the alternatives and how might this have looked? And it's just a chance to kind of, you know, second guess and think about, and explore, and do it in a fun way. That's, I think fun anyway, but I think it's also a really useful critical thinking exercise.
Yeah.
So we can do it seriously too, not just with beer and cigars, but okay, let's, you know, this is essentially what the Army does with staff rides. Okay. Let's be in this moment. Mm. What were the options?
Yeah.
What were the ramifications? And really explore this moment.
So did you all pick the topics and then pick people that you thought would would have something to say on it? How did you decide who wrote all of these?
That's a great question. And sort of the way we do it with Emerging Civil War is, you know, we'll come up with an idea for a book like this, and then we'll put out a call to our contributors, and we'll say, all right, we're working on a book on the great what ifs. Send us your ideas. If you were to write about this topic, which specific topic would you want to write about? And tell us a little bit about how you'd approach that. So, you know, we end up with, you know, maybe 20 proposals, 25 proposals. And then the co-editor and I will kind of go through that and, you know, what's the most compelling, what might be a really interesting question people wouldn't think of. And so we balance all that together to come up with sort of a menu of topics that we think would be provocative, that would be an interesting conversation with each other, got different writing styles from the different contributors. And, you know, geez, do we have the Eastern Theater and the Western Theater and the Trans-Mississippi cover, you know? So
yeah,
a lot of balancing. And so it isn't like, I think we've got 12 essays in this book, and it's not like the other, you know, 15 were bad. It's just, how do they all balance out with each other?
Right.
And so if we've got seven people that want to do Gettysburg, well, we only really need one.
Right.
So,
you know, yes, that's right. What I found was fascinating when I get the book and see it. It appears on the cover anyway that's Stonewall Jackson. It looks like Stonewall Jackson, although I guess you can make the argument, no, it's not supposed. It doesn't have to be.
So the cover photo we used is actually Oliver Otis Howard on Cemetery Hill at Gettysburg in a snowstorm. And the photo was taken by Chris Heisey, who's one of our contributors.
Okay.
People might know his work because for years and years and years he did photography for the American Battlefield Trust. And so he sent me a bunch of pictures. I said, here's the theme. Give me some picture ideas. And so this photo of Howard in this snowstorm, and he's, you know, half the statue is windswept with snow.
Yeah.
And so it sort of looks like a black and white sketch.
It does. Yeah.
And so it sort of, to me, like, could be almost anybody.
Yeah.
You know?
I figured it was. I just thought, just because, and we'll after the break, we'll talk about some of these what ifs. And I thought, to me, it drew it in because I thought, that's Stonewall Jackson. The more I looked at it, I thought, I'm sure it's not, but it's sort of in that in between kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, Oliver Otis Howard gets no love at all, ever, anywhere. So the fact that he's on the cover of this book, hopefully somewhere he's feeling okay about that.
Yeah, yeah. That's a story in a person I'm not aware of. So all of these, when we come back from the break, we'll get into it. Is there Is there a what if the Chris Makowski is one of your favorite what ifs?
Well, actually, what if Stonewall Jackson had survived his wounding? And I had written about that on our blog at Emerging Civil War. And I've always just been fascinated by that question and people's assumptions about that question, which we'll talk about in a second. And so that's really the impetus for this book. So for the book, we had Chris White write about it. Chris is a Jackson skeptic. I'm a Jackson fanboy. And since I had written about the topic, I wanted someone else to write about that topic for the book.
We're going to jump into that. A lot of these, we're going to run into these what-ifs. Again, it's the great what-ifs of the American Civil War. Where can people get this?
You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. I don't think the local park bookstore carries it, although feel free to go in and ask them for it. If enough people do, they'll start carrying it.
Yeah.
SavisBeatty.com, which is the publisher. And if you order it through them, you can get the signed copies, actually.
Okay. So. Again, it's the great what-ifs of the American Civil War, edited by Chris Makowski and Brian Matthew Jordan. More coming up on News Talk 1230 WFVA, coming up on 8:30.
I had the radio on. I'm listening to
Talk Done Right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Brought to you by EV Mobility. Here to keep you moving. For daily life, travel, or just having fun, visit goevmobility.com. You can weigh in about today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
Chris Makowski in this morning. We are talking Civil War and the great what-ifs of the American Civil War, a book that he edited along with Brian Matthew Jordan. How did you two get together and get to know each other?
Brian actually had been at Gettysburg College, and for the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg, Chris White and I and Brian were kind of put on a three-person panel for discussions on the first day of the battle. So that's where I first got to know him. And he's just a very affable guy. He comes from southwestern Ohio. And so, like, his folks were involved with a round table there. And so, like, he and Chris kind of knew each other through that. And he's just someone that you know, as we got going with Emerging Civil War, it's like, oh, we really like this guy's stuff. Maybe we can kind of get him involved. And shortly thereafter, he became a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for History for his book Marching Home, which was about how Union veterans dealt with the war after the war. It's a brilliant book.
I'll have to read that. That sounds interesting.
I love the book. And so we've just become friends over the years as a result of that. And he is hands down one of the most brilliant historians working in Civil War history today. And I'm not just saying that because he's my friend. He's a brilliant guy. So we'd just sort of been looking for an opportunity to have a project together. And I said, well, what if we pull together this volume on what ifs? He and I had also been working together on a book series we were doing with Southern Illinois University Press, some of these other essay books with emerging Civil War authors. We did one on pop culture. We did one on turning points of the Civil War. So this was just kind of the latest collaboration in that effort. Just a really, really smart guy who I've always learned something talking to him. Which to me is one of the main reasons for doing history. It's like, what can I learn today? How can I see this stuff differently?
Yeah. Well, when I saw this book on my desk, I opened it up and immediately looked for this for the chapter. What if Stonewall Jackson had not been shot? And I sat there and I read the whole chapter before I had read anything else of the book. To me, the one line that I thought just kind of changed my thinking on this and really other things was where the author says, Thomas J. Jackson was not Napoleon, nor was he even at the top of the pecking order of the Southern chain of command. Mm-hmm. That sentence to me said a lot and made me kind of recalibrate how I look upon this thing.
Well, you know, Jackson in particular has become so shrouded in myth and legend because he's the great Confederate martyr. And so he's been put on a pedestal for 160 years. And I say this in full affection as a Jackson fanboy. He was not all that in a bag of chips. And we do him a huge disservice when we think of him as a marble person. When we think of any of these people as marble people, you know, we really need to think of him as human beings just like you and me, because they were human beings just like you and me, Ted.
Yeah.
And then when we see them in that respect, we can understand them a little bit better. We can understand the mistakes they made. We can understand and appreciate the value of their bravery. And so I think just that recontextualization is really important. As you know from reading the story, sort of one of the, you know, we do a pull the carpet out from under you a little bit, because as people think about, well, what if Stonewall Jackson had survived Chancellorsville? Chris's essay doesn't actually try to answer that question.
It doesn't. I know. Yes. As I read, I kept thinking, where is this? Come on, are you going to come back around? Which I thought we had at the end afterwards, because he gives a conclusion and everything. I thought he did a really brilliant job of talking about this.
And I think that's why some people get skeptical of what ifs, because people do have a tendency to want to answer them with the answer they want, you know, and like they want Stonewall Jackson to survive so that he'll go to Gettysburg and win the Battle of Gettysburg, mm-hmm. and the Confederates will, and like there's no way you can game that scenario forward. So what Chris's essay actually does, and what the other essays in this book do, is they try to explain why you can't answer the question, why you can't game that forward. So in the case of Stonewall Jackson, well, you know, hey, he's got pneumonia. So let's say he survives. Well, he still has to get over his pneumonia, you know?
Right.
So that's a significant issue. If he survives, does Lee reorganize the army in the wake of Chancellorsville? Which he does do, because Jackson's out of the picture. And so, you know, he makes three corps instead of two. Probably doesn't do that if Jackson's still there. So that would then change the route of the army as it marched out of the Fredericksburg area and headed north. They might not even go to Gettysburg, you know? A.P. Yeah. Hill, who becomes one of the corps commanders as Jackson's replacement. People forget Jackson had court-martial charges standing against Hill. So let's say Jackson survives. Well, now he's going to have to pursue that court-martial against Hill. How does that change the dynamics in the army? Does Lee transfer Hill out west to get him away from that? And so, like, all these things are going on that,
yeah,
that people don't even think about, when suddenly they're just going to put Jackson in Gettysburg and win the battle. And it's like, yeah, Jackson probably would never even get there, and here's why.
That's what makes this just, it's, and you, it goes on and on with just a number of things. I another one that I thought was really good. What if Lee had waged a guerrilla warfare? And I that got me thinking on some different things.
Because he did have subordinates who came to him the night before the final surge at Appomattox on the evening of the 8th. And he said, why don't we just disband tonight, we'll go off into the mountains and reform and then have this guerrilla warfare. And Lee's like, absolutely not. But that idea that Lee could have taken his army and conducted this guerrilla warfare was something that was being actively discussed. What if he had happened? And of course, you know, we see the impact of guerrilla warfare today in our own military and the experience people had, yeah, when they were overseas. And so, you know, it's a really intriguing thought. Barton Myers, who wrote that essay, really does a good job of explaining why that's not an option for Lee, even though other people were really kind of considering it. And then he then looks at other instances of guerrilla warfare in the Civil War, and what lessons could we learn from those other examples that might inform how things would have played out for Lee. And, you know, certainly John Mosby in Northern Virginia had a successful, quote unquote, guerrilla career. But a lot of other guerrilla fighters did not, you know?
Yeah.
And Barton talks about that.
The other one, what if Lincoln had lived?
And this is the one that Brian writes. He co-authored this with Evan Rothero, who's a college professor. And, you know, this idea, like, if Lincoln hadn't been assassinated, what might have happened? How would that have? And I really do think that that's, you know, one of the huge turning points in American history, because, yeah, as the Confederacy is in its last throes, you know, Lincoln pulls Grant aside, he pulls Sherman aside, he pulls Admiral Porter aside, and, you know, let him up easy, you know, let's, you know, be merciful. Think about those lines from his second inaugural, you know, with charity to all, with malice toward none.
Yeah.
You know, that's this philosophy that Lincoln has. So how might he have put that into effect after the Confederacy surrendered? Well, we'll never know because Andrew Johnson comes in and then the radical Republicans take over and there's this very hard malice, no charity sort of attitude.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating question. And Brian and Evan really kind of get into what some of those political ramifications were and what the context was for that moment and why it's such an important moment.
In each of the ones, because I think on a lot of these, we've all thought of it, but never thought of it to this level or with this kind of scholarship. And that's what makes this such a fascinating book to me.
Yeah, because I think, you know, people say like, oh, yeah, if Lincoln had lived, you know, things would have been entirely different, blah, 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 blah. And like, how could we ever know?
Right.
You know, how could we ever know?
Yeah.
You know, because he's still got a dicey political situation he's got to wade into. You know, because the radical Republicans weren't united behind him.
No, so, no. Well, the other thing on this, Chris Makowski here this morning as we talk about the great what ifs of the American Civil War, a book that he and Brian Matthew Jordan edited together. What if Great Britain had intervened? There's something that I had never thought of worldwide as the world watched.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What if that had happened?
And it's one of those things that, again, makes Antietam such an important turning point because the federal victory is skin of the teeth as it was there. That's enough to discourage Great Britain and France from getting into the war. And people always say, like, well, gosh, well, what if they had gotten into the war? And they assume that here's going to be this, huge global shift in dynamics. And now we'll be fighting a war on two fronts, which Lincoln didn't want to do. And that was always the threat. And Dwight spent some time looking at, like, well, what was the situation for Great Britain at that time? And would they have been as a daunting threat as we assume they would be? And, actually, Great Britain would have been in a terrible position at that time to fight a war against us because they didn't have a land army. It would have been a naval battle, and we had iron ships before they did. So, there are some interesting things to kind of consider that, you know, maybe we shouldn't assume that that would have turned the tide in a significant sort of way.
Like you said, you deal with a whole. It's not just around here where you're dealing with things. You talk about the Maryland campaign and Shiloh in Missouri and Jefferson Davis being loyal to Braxton Bragg.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anybody who follows the story of the armies out west knows that the commander out there for much of the war is a guy named Braxton Bragg, who is grumpy, not especially competent, and he is hated by his officers and many of his men. And yet Jefferson Davis sustains him. And like, well, why does he sustain him as long as he does? Why does he back him? Even, you know, he sends Joe Johnson out there twice to replace him. And Johnson, well, you know, and it's like, how does Braxton Bragg survive? And what are the implications for this army as a result? And what if Davis had made some different command decisions? And that really speaks to the dysfunction. So that essay by Cecily Zander really kind of gets into this, the dysfunction of what's going out there and really looks at those dynamics and how it impacts what's going on in each of the battles and over the course of the war there.
A lot of differences for you between editing a book and writing a book?
Oh, for sure. One of the things I like about it is just the different writing styles and topics. So for me, there's just a lot of freshness in the conversation and how can we juxtapose these ideas against each other so that someone can pick this up and read through it and always have something new to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And then as they get deeper into the book, how do those later essays, how are they informed by maybe some of the things people have learned early in the book, you know? So if you start this book and you read Timothy Smith's essay about Shiloh and that gets you thinking, well, how does that thinking process then affect the way you read Cecily Zander's piece about Jefferson Davis later, in Braxton Bragg. And so to me, that kind of interplay is really important too.
Interesting. Another one that I had never even considered, what if someone else had been offered the command of the Army of the Potomac? That to me was one I thought, I've never thought of that.
Yeah. We think about George McClellan coming back to command of the army after Second Manassas, and Lincoln says, well, we have to use the tools we have available to
right.
us. You know, it's kind of like a consolation, like, oh, well, we don't have any other choices. But Frank Jastrzemski's essay talks about different instances where other people did have the opportunity to get called on for command. And, you know, he doesn't play that forward, you know, so that if Phil Kearney gets command of the Army, here's what he's going to go off and do.
Right.
But sort of like, why was Kearney an option in the first place? What was his record actually like? And he actually chooses a couple different people who had legitimate options, opportunities, and sort of, you know, well, here's who this person was, and here's what they were thinking at the time.
Yeah. No, it does. So. A whole lot of things come out of this. This can't be the only book in this series.
So right now we've got a second set of essays that we're trying to pull together. You know, we can only fit so much in one book.
Yeah.
And we knew as soon as we were pulling this together, like, oh, there's too many good things here. This has some of the kind of the greatest hits. There's an essay in here about the what ifs of the Maryland campaign, like, oh, you know, Lee and the Lost or McClellan and the Lost Order and that sort of thing. But, you know, there are a lot of Gettysburg what-ifs that we couldn't touch on. The big one here is, what if James Longstreet did go around the right of the line?
Yeah.
But, you know, what if the Confederates had captured Little Round Top? What if Meade had attacked Lee along the Potomac after the battle? You know, and so those are going to be essays in the next volume. So we do have a second one coming up, and we're going to get to explore that, some of those sorts of questions in volume two. What if John Brown had succeeded? What if Kentucky had gone with the Confederacy? Let's see, what if what if Ulysses S. Grant, this is one of my favorites, what if Grant had gone to Port Hudson when he crossed the Mississippi instead of going after Vicksburg? Because he was actually ordered to go south, and he disobeyed orders to carry out the Vicksburg campaign, figuring that it took 8 days for a telegraph to get from him all the way back to D.C. and then back to him. And he says, you can do an awful lot in 8 days. So his plan was to disobey orders, get into Mississippi, score some victories, and then ask for forgiveness instead of permission.
Interesting. As a postscript, you write in this book,
yes,
what if George Meade had been captured at Spotsylvania?
And we included that in there just as a way to illustrate that beer and cigars approach. Dan Davis, who's a historian with the American Battlefield Trust, he and I were down at the Capitol Ale House downtown one day and having a beer. And we were talking about Myers Hill and the acquisition that Central Virginia Battlefield Trust made up there. And one of the things that makes that piece of ground so important is that George Meade was almost captured by the Confederates on the 14th of May. And so Dan and I are like, well, what if he had gotten captured? Well, who's going to be his replacement? And so it became a chance for us to talk about the officer corps and, you know, who was good and who was on the outs and who had flaws and, like, what would have the options been? And to me, that's, again, why these are valuable critical thinking exercises, because you suddenly, Dan and I could better understand the Army Corps and the officers in that moment. And it was an excuse to talk about the officers in a way that helped us better understand the command structure.
There's some great pictures and sketches in this book too that I had never seen and add to it all.
So we tried to use some things from the Library of Congress collection. They're all publicly available in public domain. And so just something that kind of helps illustrate those in ways that make people better visualize what's going on.
Well, and like you said, you had a lot to choose from. It's about 250 pages. It's a nice size. It's the kind of size you can carry around and underline things, and you know you can take it with you somewhere, and when you have a break, you know, you can look like, you know, a historian by, you know, this is what I'm reading today.
And because they're essays, you know, you can read them in chunks, you can sample, you don't have to read them in order, you know, and that gives you the chance to move through the book in that way too.
So. The Great What Ifs of the American Civil War. It's edited by Chris Makowski, who is in studio with us this morning, and Brian Matthew Jordan. And again, we're number of ways you can get this, Amazon and other spots.
Sure. So I'm going to tantalize folks. We've got a symposium coming up about this very topic, and you'd be able to get copies of the book there.
Where's the symposium?
So on August 5th, 6th, and 7th at Stevenson Ridge in Spotsylvania, we'll have our annual Emerging Civil War Symposium. This is our eighth year, and our theme this year is actually built around this book. And so we've got The Great Widows of the Civil War. We'll have the book available for folks there. And we've got some of these topics. We've got different authors talking about some of these topics versus the people who wrote them. So again, trying to create conversation about some of these topics. Our keynote speaker is going to be Gary Adelman from the American Battlefield Trust. And Gary's a licensed battlefield guide at Gettysburg, and he's going to talk about the what ifs of Gettysburg. And then we're really excited to have Gordon Ray come back. Gordon is sort of the dean of scholars of the Overland Campaign. His books on the wilderness, Spotsy, North Anna, Cold Harbor are the definitive works. And he's going to talk about the what ifs of the Overland Campaign. Brian Matthew Jordan, again, Pulitzer Prize finalist, he's going to come back and sort of talk about, how is it that what ifs help us frame our discussions. And then we've got two panel discussions. One will be about the what ifs of the Antietam campaign. So if folks are wondering about the lost order or other things, they can talk about that. And then a general what ifs panel. And then beyond all of that, we have seven other speakers too. So it's a Friday night, all day Saturday, and then Sunday we'll wrap up with a tour of the Slaughter Pen Farm, and we'll talk about some of the what ifs of Fredericksburg on Saturday. So $225 for ticket covers all 3 days. You get some lunch in there on Saturday and chance to talk with all these historians.
Great stuff. August 5th, 6th, and 7th at Stevenson Ridge in Spotsylvania. Go to emergingcivilwar.com for
correct
information.
Order your tickets there and find out more information.
Quick break. We'll wrap it up with Chris Makowski on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Opinions, we've all got them, and we'd like to hear yours on Town Talk. Brought to you by EB Mobility, here to keep you moving. For daily life, travel, or just having fun, visit goevmobility.com. Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubert.
Before we get out of here, Chris Makowski here, the great what ifs of the American Civil War. There are a lot of what ifs we didn't talk about. I'll let you touch on them before we get out of here.
Yeah, sure. And the foreword is written by Pete Soros, who is an alternative history fiction writer, and he's written a number of alternate histories, and so he was kind enough to do the foreword for us here. And then I've got this an introduction to the book that really kind of sets the context and talks about alternate history as fiction and nonfiction, counterfactual history, and kind of does a what we'd call a literature review, some of the novels and books that have been written about it. Tim Smith's piece on Shiloh is one of my favorites. Shiloh is this birth of the, part of the lost cause. And what if Albert Sidney Johnson hadn't been killed? And Tim basically said, things wouldn't have changed. Wouldn't have made a difference.
Yeah.
Kevin Pollack's piece on the Maryland campaign, Dwight Hughes, as you said, Great Britain's intervention, Frank Drzemski's piece on the different people who might have been command of the Army of the Potomac, Chris White's Stonewall Jackson piece, Dan Welch's piece on what if James Longstreet had gone around to the right at Gettysburg. One of the big, big what ifs of the
Civil
War.
That was interesting.
There. Cecily Zander had that piece on Braxton Bragg. I actually wrote about the North Anna River, and which is my favorite phase of the Overland campaign. So many possibilities for things to go off the rails there, and they didn't. And so my piece looks at that. Kristen Trout looks at Sterling Price's 1864 Missouri expedition. Jonathan Noyalis from Shenandoah University talks about the election of 64. If Lincoln hadn't been reelected, what might have happened?
I forgot about that one. Yeah, that was a good one.
Tantalizing possibilities there. Because, again, lots of ways that could have gone off the rails.
Yeah.
Bart Meyer's piece on the guerrilla war and Brian and Evan's piece on Lincoln's survival. So, and then we offer some suggested readings at the end. So if people want to read about any of these topics in more depth, we've got reading lists that people can explore.
This hour went way too fast. There are other things I want to ask you about and talk to you about, but we will do this again soon.
What if we had more time?
What if we had more time? Yes. Chris Makowski. Chris, thank you so much. Thanks for what you provide to this community and just Civil War history in general.
Thanks so much for having me, Ted. It's my privilege.
We'll do this again soon. Chris Makowski with us this morning. Again, the great what ifs of the American Civil War. Get it. You'll enjoy it. That's it. Thanks for listening. See you in the morning.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. brought to you by EV Mobility, here to keep you moving. For daily life, travel, or just having fun, visit goevmobility.com. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. Hear Town Talk anytime by subscribing to the Town Talk podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. The Glenn Beck program is next on News Talk 1230 WFBA.